Mr. Chairman.
Hey, who's down there at the far end? Call to order the Senate Jobs and Economic Growth Committee, Tuesday, March 6th. Is that right? Wow.
I know.
Good morning, members. So we have three bills in front of us. I'm going to have the multi-talented Senator Metzen chair the committee for the first bill here. We have Senate File 2067 with Senator Daley. Members, I'll also note that to my right, I have Lucas Ness from Senate staff, our all-star committee administrator. Amy Berger's got some health issues, so we hope to see her back very soon. Could be today, could be tomorrow, but we've got a good substitute in her place. So, member, Senate File 2067, and thank you, Senator Metzen.
Senator Daley, Senate File 2067, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll do a brief overbill, and then we'll look at the bill itself. This bill, Senate File 2067, has strong bipartisan support. I want to take a moment to thank my co-authors, Senator Kielash and Senator Metzen. The bill is quite basic, members. It simply extends the existing three-day right-to-cancel provisions of the home solicitation sale statutes to include contracts for the improvement of real property. The three-day right-to-cancel law has been on the books since 1973, and it protects consumers from high-pressure and questionable in-home sales practices. A 2006 Court of Appeals decision held that exclusion for sale of real property means that improvements to real property are also to be excluded. So we needed to add this language. The new law would only apply to situations where the contractor initiates contact with the consumer, not in cases where the consumer contacts the contractor. The Department of Labor and Industry and the Better Business Bureau have received many complaints from many homeowners who sign contracts only to get rid of salesmen who are employing high-pressure sales tactics, thinking they can cancel the next day. And here's the key issue that many of these homeowners are facing. In those cases, the contractor refuses to allow the cancellation unless the homeowner pays a cancellation penalty, which is generally 25% of the contractor. If you do a $20,000 home remodel project, because this language isn't excluded, the homeowner feels pressured into it. They sign the deal. $20,000 contract means at 25%, they've got to pay $5,000 to get out of that contract, and they have nothing to show for it. This is a nonpartisan consumer issue, members. The bill is supported by the Better Business Bureau, the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and Minnesota Association for Exterior Specialists. As I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, this is a bipartisan solution, and I'd ask for member support. We do have several members in the audience who'd like to testify.
Senator Daley, we have probably two listed, but Dana Badgerow and Charlie Dernberger, you want to bring them folks up to the table? Commissioner, how are you?
Mr. Chair, I'm just fine. Thank you very much. It's lovely to be back.
Well, is that, you mean that?
I do.
Okay. Senator Daley, what? Badgerow to start?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senators, I'm Dana Badgerow, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota, which incidentally is the first Better Business Bureau in the United States, and we're celebrating our 100-year anniversary this year. I'm here this morning in support of Senate File 2067, which would clarify and make explicit the coverage of the three-day cancellation provision to home improvement work. Last year in 2011, the Better Business Bureau received over 24,000 complaints concerning companies in our service area. Of those, a large number were from consumers who posed issues with home remodeling and repair projects. In fact, we have our top 10 industries that receive complaints, and five of those top 10 are in the home improvement and remodeling business. We received nearly 10,000 inquiries from consumers by telephone and over 1.6 million consumers who accessed our business reviews on our website, who are checking out companies, hopefully before they enter into contracts, And we have reports on over 60,000 companies in our service area. They include the complaint history, government actions, their licensure status, time in business, and other relevant details, and we give them a letter grade from A-plus to F. We always advise consumers to, quote, check before you buy to protect themselves. Unfortunately, there's a breed of home improvement contractor, however, it doesn't give consumers a chance to check with the BBB, and these are the companies that solicit business door-to-door, often with unrelenting and tiresome pitches late into the night, high-pressure sales techniques, and misleading information about the condition of the property. These predatory contractors often have highly inflated prices for their work, and their visits are often characterized by a false sense of urgency, telling the homeowners that they must sign or the offer will not be good tomorrow. Again, competition is lacking, prices are often inflated, and the homeowner feels either cowed or desperate to get the repairs made, and these are not decisions that are made in the light of day with full knowledge and information. So I just, to illustrate that these laws really are important to Minnesota consumers, I have brought with me three cases that I'll briefly review with you. These are cases handled by the Better Business Bureau against Minnesota companies. This first one is from a consumer in Eveleth, Minnesota, who was visited by a Twin Cities contractor late in the evening. After a cold call, we agreed to meet with the salesman to talk about windows. He was late the first night, so he agreed to come back again the next night. After talking to my husband and myself for a while, he still didn't get through his presentation and asked to come again the next night. I asked if I had to sign anything tonight, and he said, yes, you do. We asked if he could come back tomorrow, and he said, no, he's headed back to the Twin Cities. It was getting late, and I had a very early serving shift at the restaurant. I get up at 3:40 a.m. to get to work by 4:50. He said he had to get back to the cities, and it had to be then to get the deal he was giving us, so I caved and signed a lot of contracts without a whole lot of time to really read them. Part of one contract said we had to buy four windows or pay 25% of the contract, which was $17,000, if we backed out. I panicked, tried to get back out of the deal the next day, thinking I did have a three-day grace period. One person we dealt with said we had to at least pay for food and lodging for the salesman. Then the owner said he was not okay with him, so he would no longer even sell us the four windows. He offered to settle for us for 12.5%, so we paid $2,138 to get out of this transaction. In a second case, in Excelsior, the company called me and came over that day, that evening. There were two sales guys. They checked the windows. They were all good except for one, but then they went to the attic and found out I had frost on my plywood and needed insulation. We sat down around, and they said, just guess the price, and I said $1,500. They gave me a price of around $4,500, and I said, no, I have to pay off my motorcycle, and I don't know if I'm going to have my job. They just kept telling me this was such a good deal. I said, no, they told me that other companies would get this product and that the prices would go up. Then they asked me for some water, so I gave them water. I was ready to sign that I wanted to reject the offer, and then the other sales guy does, well, what about another offer if we reduce the price to $3,570? They just couldn't believe I said no to their wonderful product. I even asked for an estimate, and then they gave me a 10% discount as a first user. I signed, but I had to wake up the next morning for work, and my body was shutting down, so I said yes, signed the contract just to get them out of my house. And a final one, which is, I think if this person were here and this testimony would be quite relevant. I was called on a cold call on July 12th for an in-home assessment of a need for more insulation. I agreed my wife and I would meet with a salesperson at 8 p.m., but not only one but two salespersons came, checked the attic, and began a sales pitch which went on for a total of 2.25 hours. My wife would not sign, but finally after they came down in price, stating this was their best one-time offer and I would never get a chance as good as this offer, I signed. I was tired after working that day and would have to start at 7:30 the next morning. My wife checked the Better Business Bureau the next day and found that complaints against the couple for hard sell tactics. So that very day, I sent a letter to the company stating I wanted to cancel the contract based on this 72-hour rule in Minnesota about canceling contracts. The company stated that I could not cancel without paying them 25%. They contend that, quote, improvements to real property qualify under the sale of real property exception and therefore are not a home solicitation sale. I received opinions from the Office of Attorney General and Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry and a private attorney. Two separate bids to do the same work, for half the price quoted to me by this company. I discovered from my investigation from the Attorney General, the Department of Labor and Industry, and the attorney that indeed state law did not back up my understanding of the 72-hour rule for this type of contract. I feel the law needs to be changed. Thank you very much.
Mr. Dernberger, 2221 Acorn Lane.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, that was quite a long time ago. Yeah, we're old neighbors.
No, your parents bought that house from my mother, the Dernbergers. I'm giving you a little
way history. Way back. We were neighbors in a sense.
Like I'm just a kid, so.
I was a twinkle in my dad's eye at that point.
Mr. Dernberger.
Mr. Chairman, it's great to be here. Yeah, thank you very much. All I want to do here, my name is Charlie Dernberger. I'm with the Department of Labor and Industries Construction Codes and Licensing Division, and my staff looks at the same types of complaints that Commissioner Badgerow was talking about that the Better Business Bureau gets, and I'm just here to indicate the support that the department has for Senator Daley's bill. We think it's a great idea. It does address a lot of problems that we've seen similar to what the Better Business Bureau has seen, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that members of the committee may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the? I think you're doing pretty good here, Senator Daley. Anybody in the audience wish to speak against this bill? Senator Thomas Winnie.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this committee runs pretty smoothly under your direction.
and he won't come out from hiding. I think, is this going to the floor, or what? Is it part of something else, or no?
Senator Mattson, Mr. Chairman, this will go to the straight to the floor, as I understand.
Okay, I think we're ready for a motion. Senator Daley, do you wish to make the motion?
I would like to. I move that this be passed and sent to the Senate floor.
Okay, any further discussion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed and sent to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well done, Senator Mattson. Thank you.
You want to keep these moving? I'll...
And former Commissioner Badgerow, nice to see you.
Sir.
We knew that Mattson would take care of things, so
thanks
for coming today. So Senator Daley, we'll continue at the end of the table here. Senate File 2065.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm going to provide a brief overview and some background, the bill and my author's amendment. This bill, Senate File 2065, again, has strong bipartisan support. I want to take a moment again to thank co-authors Senator Mattson, Senator Thomasoni, of course, you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this contractor recovery fund is a quasi-bond insurance fund into which every contractor pays an annual fee when they renew their contractor's license. The issue we're working to resolve here is that the fund is nearly depleted and legislative action is required to restore these funds. Our resolution has involved close coordination with the Builders Association of Minnesota and the Department of Labor and Industry, including Commissioner Peterson and Mr. Rakowski. I'd also like to thank Senator Torres Ray for the conversation that she and I had yesterday after the floor session. We talked about the disappointing action of the 2003 legislature to raid this contractor recovery fund of about $2.3 million hard-earned dollars from private sector building contractors intended for the purposes of this contractor fund and not for general fund. We know at this point it's not realistic to expect the money to be returned. However, it is our intent to ensure that this does not happen again. Mr. Chairman, at this point, I'd like to move the A1 author's amendment and then walk through the bill as amended with the members.
All right, Senator Daley, I think what you said was you want to move
A2.
The A2. And members, does everyone have the A2? Okay.
Yes.
Senator Daley moves the A2. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A2 is adopted. Senator Daley.
Members, you'll see on line 1.7 in the amendment, the A2 amendment, that we're providing greater choice. There's another option for the continuing ed. As you flip through to the next page, the amendment, you'll notice, and this is the focus of the intent of the bill, that the fees change in July of 2013 and again in July of 2015. And this language was language that was worked out between the Builders Association of Minnesota and the agency to come up with a predictable, easy-to-plan-out kind of schedule.
So, Daly, I have Mr. Peterson, Commissioner Peterson, and Pam Perry's at the table. Any kind of order do you want for this testimony or anything more that further that you wish to present?
Just a couple more items.
Very good.
You know, the focus was the Contractor Recovery Fund. As the Builders Association and the agency had the house opened up, they said, well, this we might as well finish up our punch list at the same time. So there's a couple other items. As you look at page 3 of the A2, there were two forms. So there was a form up to 2007, a different form from 2007 to current, and now this allows for a combined form to simplify the process. I think there might have been one or two other small points. Give me just a moment here. If you flip,
Senator Daly, while you're flipping through there, Senate Counsel has a. Something that she'd like to add to this discussion.
Mr. Chair, members, I have one technical correction on line 3.10. I would suggest that we change the that's before section to this. It should be this section.
You want to restate that one more time,
sure.
Ms. Fontaine, and then I'll
sure.
have Senator Daly offer that as a
sure.
oral amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, on line 3.10 of the A2 amendment, delete the and insert this.
All right, Senator Daly offers that as an oral amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, Ms. Fontaine. Senator Daly.
Just to wrap up, Mr. Chairman, members, if you could go to the original bill. To 3.8 in the original bill, we're striking that language. This language was offered 10 years ago, and because there are two different funds, there's a Construction Codes and Licensing Division and this Contractor Recovery Fund. That language is already covered in the Construction Codes and Licensing Division, so we're striking it from here so that it's not in both places. And finally, the last item is the repealer. 2.18 and 4.10 are connected. And the commissioner agreed, along with the Builders Association, that along with the changes that we made with the fund, the prices and those fees, that this language is no longer necessary. With that, I'd like to turn it over to either the commissioner or Ms. Perry.
Ms. Perry, the nods seem to be going towards your side of the table, so thank you for the work that you've done with the department and with the author, and if you'd like to give whatever broad or specific testimony you'd like, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pam Perry. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. We represent the residential construction industry here in Minnesota. Every licensed contractor in the state is required to pay into the Contractor Recovery Fund. As Senator Daly said, it acts as a quasi-bond. In residential construction, builders don't pull bonds. We pay into the Contractor Recovery Fund. If a builder goes belly up or they're unable to meet their obligations, a homeowner can get a judgment against the court in court and get remuneration from the Contractor Recovery Fund. We are coming to you with this bill this year because those of you who served on the Jobs Conference Committee last year will remember that the department came forward and was concerned with the solvency and if there's enough money in the fund to pay claims. The Department of Labor and Industry had the ability to increase the fee by $200 in statute without coming to the legislature. I think the commissioner felt uncomfortable doing that, and we agreed to work over the summer to find a more reasonable solution. Senator Daly referred you to, in the Senator Daly's original bill, we had recommended a cost of living adjustment to the contractor recovery fund rather than just immediate jump in $200 right off the bat. The department, we discussed a cost of living adjustment, and they thought that a straight small fee increase would be easier to do from an administrative side, and so that's why you see the fee increase, the small fee increase in the amendment. Frankly, the industry would not like to see an immediate $200 jump. We would like to see something more predictable over a period of time. We are supportive of the Contractor Recovery Fund. We think that it works. The department does a great job of administering it, and we want to make sure it remains solvent.
So thank you, Ms. Perry. So look over to the commissioner then. Commissioner Peterson, welcome back to the committee, and thank you. If you want to give a little background then on the work that you have done with, again, both the author and with Ms. Perry and her group.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Ken Peterson, Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, and would certainly like to thank Ms. Perry as well as Senator Daley and the other members for working on this. It's been the problem has been that since the downturn in the housing area, we've had fewer and fewer licensed contractors, and unfortunately, we've had more claims. Now, we're not quite sure what we can attribute that to, but we are seeing more claims. Maybe contractors are putting in bids they really can't live up to because of just the need to survive. We're not quite sure what it is. Same time, we are receiving more claims, and so we're having drawing down the fund more. So we need some more money in it. Same time, everybody in the department, and myself included, are very sympathetic to the problems that the housing industry is running into. I mean, we all know about it. It's a tough industry. The contractors may have had great years in the early 2000s. They're not having such a great time now. And so we want to do everything we can do to assure that we're not driving people out of business or, even worse, making them not be licensed and continue to operate, and then they wouldn't be covered by this at all. So we do think that the resolution is very good. We think we'll have sufficient funds to continue to operate in covering those claimants, those homeowners who have been in one fashion or another ripped off or dealt deceptive or shoddy practices by a home contractor.
Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, I just have a question about the amendment and on page 3, the new language. Right above the new language, it says commissioner shall pay compensation from the fund for a final judgment based on a contract directly between the licensee and the homeowner or lessee that was entered into prior to the cause of action, and that requires licensure. And then the new language says all claims regardless of the date. Are those two things contrary?
With the they're not.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, what we're trying to get at in the second one is this law was passed in 1974. It's been revised several times since, and the last time in 2007, we are operating a program for claims prior to 2007 and for claims after 2007. This would just make them all equal. And no one gets hurt. But prior to 2007, the top limit was $50,000. After 2007, it was $75,000. This would increase it for everybody for $75,000. And it would make it a lot simpler for us to operate. Right now, we have to we pay out claims in November and March, I believe, or maybe November and June. I'm sorry, November and June. And so this would eliminate that. And we'd be able to operate the thing much more smoothly. And we don't believe it costs us any more, substantially more. And we think it works for the betterment of the industry as well as as the department.
So, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, that regardless of the date of fraudulent, deceptive, dishonest practices, it is in reference to what year it happened.
In 2007.
Not in reference to that date that was right above where I read.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That's right.
Okay.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator or Commissioner, this is a revenue recovery fund is paid for by the contractors. Is that correct?
Yes.
For the purpose the bill talks about. Somebody said earlier, I think it was Mr. Daley, that we use the word rated. this fund to help the general fund last year.
2003.
Well, how long ago was it?
I think it was 2003.
And we've been taking money to balance general fund ever since out of this one?
My understanding.
Or just the one time?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, my understanding is just that one time in 2003.
And Mr. Chairman, we never paid back that money that the contractors paid for a specific purpose. Is that correct?
That is my understanding, yes,
yeah,
Senator Metzen.
That's water over the dam, but that's not what these contractors thought they paid it in for, and I think we better be very careful around here. I think there was an issue last year, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure which fund it was, but I think the unemployment fund or something where Senator Gerlach's bill took $25 million also out of that fund. And I should have done my homework, but I know they took $25 million out of there for something to help balance the general fund, not for the purpose it was paid in for. So we got to be very careful,
Mr. Chairman,
going forward, because the contractors paid this in for not to balance the statement.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, the legislature began taking money out of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division Fund, which is also paid in by all licensees of the department. And the legislature is permanently transferring between $1.5 and $1.6 million a year. But Senator DeCruyff has a bill to prevent that transfer at the end of this biennium. And we are certainly supportive of that and would prefer not to have those funds continually transferred out of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division at the department.
So. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you, Senator DeCruyff, too.
Thank you, Ms. Perry. So for the commissioner, then, just so I'm clear, and if there's anything that is that it uses the word fee, that's going to be scrutinized around here, right? We all know that. So you had – this is for the commissioner, but others can answer this too. You had language which would have allowed you to assess, and you chose not to. And so you're more comfortable going with, well, frankly, asking the legislature for authority to do a fee or an assessment, and at some different levels. Is that fair, Commissioner Peterson? I just want to get a sense for where.
Mr. Chairman, that's
you
correct.
And your department.
That's correct. This is a better system. It's more predictable. We know the funds will be coming in. Contractors can plan. They can project out what their costs are going to be as well. We think it's a better system. It's not particularly that I was concerned about. That I just not necessarily was opposed to raising it. If we had to, I would have done that. But I think it's better to bring it before this body, to work it out in conjunction with the builders, and to have it discussed and open, as opposed to doing it the other way. I think it's a better approach.
Ms. Perry.
Mr. Chair, the industry is in support of this small fee increase. As the commissioner said, it's more predictable. We conducted a task force over the summer with staff from the Department of Labor and Industry. We all agreed that the construction, the contract recovery fund is important and needs to be funded at a level to protect consumers. So the industry is very supportive, and we'll certainly provide that in writing to the legislature when you debate this on the Senate floor.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. I think that's helpful, just to be clear that this is something that you support, that your members support, and that the members at this table and then in front of the full body aren't going to hear from another group that says, why are you raising fees in this kind of economy? We're going to be pretty sensitive to that.
Mr. Chair, a $200 fee increase made by the commissioner at the last minute would further erode a contractor's interest in being licensed. And again, that predictability is really critical, particularly in this environment.
Mr. Chairman, I have one technical amendment. If you would look at the A2 amendment, line 1.9, because we added "or the International Association for Continuing Education and Training" phrase, the the word IDE or the acronym IDECC is no longer necessary in line 1.9. So I would move that we strike that acronym and just say the approval must accompany the course submitted.
I'm looking at Senate Counsel. I'm getting an affirmative nod, Senator Daley, so a good catch on your part. Members, do you understand the Daley oral amendment on 1.9? Senator Daley offers that amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. That amendment is adopted. Thank you, Senator Daley. Is Senator Daley, do you have further witnesses or further testimony that you wish to bring before the committee?
I do not, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else in the audience this morning that wishes to testify on Senate File 2065? Senator Daley, as I understand, this bill then, like your other bill, would go to the floor.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jensen.
I see there's fees involved, and this is only a preliminary fiscal note. I wonder if we shouldn't send this to the Finance Committee for their review also.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. We're checking with the brain trust. That seems to make some sense.
Is it? That's that guy?
Right there.
Oh, right here.
That's it.
Fun.
Does make sense. It says that they're going back to operating for the long.
And Senator Daley, I didn't mean to trip you up there, but it should go to finance. It should go to finance. So Senator Daley moves that Senate File 2065, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Senate Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you,
thank
members.
Thank you, Senator Daley. Thank you, Ms. Perry. Thank you, Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you. Really not supposed to, though.
I think it's a big enough deal.
It's not like being a mayor of a big city like Red Wing. You just do what you want to do. Dictate.
I know.
This is called democracy. Oh. Oh, you got elected, too? Stuff in the boxes.
All right.
I just ran out.
Senator Peterson, I'd like to see a tally between you and Senator Daley as to who's carrying more bills this year. I think you're neck and neck, don't you think, Tomasoni? Don't you think these guys are pulling their weight for sure? So, Senator Peterson, thank you for bringing forward Senate File 2224. And I've got a number of people scheduled to testify and an amendment members. So, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First we need to offer the A12 amendment related to Senate File 2224 for your consideration. I did notice that was in your packet already. This amendment simply is taking the advice of Senate counsel relating to this bill, specifically to the federally mandated penalty changes that were being made in this bill. So you should have the A12 amendment there in your packet for your consideration.
Let's do this. So Senator Peterson, so everyone, I'm told we have the A12.
Yeah.
And let's move this now to put it in the shape you want, but there's enough changes here. It'd be nice if we could walk through it a little bit, okay?
So, yes, sir.
So Senator Peterson offers the A12 as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. So the A12 is adopted. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Senate File 2224 is the work of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is made up of business and labor groups from parts of Minnesota. The legislative members on that committee include myself, Senator Ted Daley, Senator David Tomasoni, as well as Senator Ken Kielash, which you'll notice are all authors on this bill as well. As I stated earlier, because of the congressional action last summer, Minnesota is required to make some changes in order for Minnesota employers to continue to receive some of the federal tax credits that are worth in the neighborhood of $750 million per year. It puts money from that from penalties on the applicants into the trust fund, so that money is being moved to the trust fund. And then it puts the penalties on employers whose failure to adequately inform the department for the reasons of the separation and overpayments of money. It also of benefits. It puts that money into the UI trust fund as well. And we have the director of the Unemployment Insurance Division, Rick Cagliarelli, and others that are going to walk through some of the details of this bill. Mr. Chair and members, I want to take this opportunity to compliment Mr. Calgary and his staff as well. As you can imagine, unemployment issues can be difficult. You're always talking to somebody that is in a very difficult time in their life, having lost a job. They're looking for answers to questions, and many of them are in a stressful situation, and Mr. Cagliarelli's staff routinely responds to those folks in that difficult situation and gets them the answers that they need.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Caligiuri, and I am director of the Unemployment Insurance Division at DEED, and with me is my colleague Lee Nelson. We are here to testify for this bill. As Senator Peterson said, the primary impetus of doing a bill this year were some federal changes that came down and requiring conformity, that we tweak the laws for conformity purposes in Minnesota. If you have any specific questions on the bill, we'd be happy to answer them. As Senator Peterson said, we are coming through a very difficult time, a very high unemployment insurance claims loads, and luckily, things are improving. The unemployment rate is going down. Requests for payment and initial claims are going down. So everything is going in the right direction. So,
thank you, Mr. Caligiuri. So, Mr. Nelson, are you prepared to kind of walk through the bill and at least highlight some of the sections in the A-12? Does that sound fit for you? I know you've done that before for us, so. If you're not ready to do that, we'll find someone else. But Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am legal counsel to the Unemployment Insurance Program. And, yes, Mr. Chairman, I can walk through any portions where you want to and discuss it for days if you want to.
Well, not that long, Mr. Nelson. No. We'd like a highlight version. And so I just want members to be clear between the bill that's been presented in the A-12 that was offered. Any highlights that you can emphasize for members would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, when Senator Peterson referred to Senate counsel, he was referring to John Fuller, not Carlin Doyle, who just had some concern. He thought the original bill at Article 1, Section 3 was a little bit awkward. And so we asked for that to be redrafted so it was a little more simplistic. It changes nothing. It's simply a rewording to make it a little easier to understand and a little easier for people to understand. That was the change in Section 3 on the amendment. The other portions of the amendment are
excuse me, Mr. Nelson, can you bring that microphone up close? I want to make sure we all hear you. Thank you.
Certainly. The other portions of the amendment are simply housekeeping. Just simply some changes which have to implement some concerns expressed by the Court of Appeals regarding some administrative rules and some other recent decisions, simply codifying those. It doesn't change the law in any other way. Those were some of the changes brought forward.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, members, I can add a couple other comments. Having served in that council, we had discussions surrounding most of these issues. Some of the other points that I think members should be aware of, which I think are positive moves, we touched briefly on the penalties that were discussed. Those are being moved to the UI Trust Fund, which basically helps deal with the expenses rather than being used in the administration, which I think is a very positive move for businesses. It also provides some greater incentive for Minnesotans to take some part-time or temporary jobs, certainly while they're on unemployment insurance as well. specifically, those are some other things that, you know, are reasons why I'm supporting the bill as an employer myself here in Minnesota. So,
Chairman. Senator Metzen.
Yeah, I'm not thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not so sure that we have to. This is a federal conformity bill. It's a housekeeping bill. It's something the bipartisan commission spent a lot of time on. And we had a good watchdog group there with Key Lash and Tomasoni on board, so I'm comfortable that I guess we don't.
No,
I'm not so sure about those guys. No. I don't think it's personally. I don't think it's necessary to go through 25 sections here, and it's things we have to do. And so, whatever. Unless you want to hear more, or the committee wants to hear more. I'm
Senator Metzen, you got a lunch appointment today?
No, but I have 25. I won't say anymore.
We all might want to come with you.
You might want to come along.
I do have at least one member of the audience I know who wants to testify. So, Senator Peterson, do you have anything further? Mr. Nelson does.
Mr. Chair, I want to.
Caligiuri does.
I want to apologize to the committee and to Senator Peterson. There was a flurry of activity this morning in completing this fiscal note. And I only remotely reviewed it for a couple of minutes. This bill is revenue neutral. We need to fix this fiscal note. We anticipate whatever costs will be offset by additional revenue. So it's a revenue neutral bill. And the fiscal note does not adequately explain that. So we will get on that right away.
Mr. Caligiuri and Senator Peterson, while you were testifying, I looked at my BlackBerry email inbox, and I got a fiscal note on this bill at 11:03. So I don't know if that's the latest one you are looking at. I share your frustration. We've had this a number of times in this committee about slow, tardy, or unclear fiscal notes. I know there's a lot of work being done by a lot of people. Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and members, I was hoping that this might slip by Mr. Jensen, but I'm not sure that it was going to as well. But, you know, my intent is to move this bill to the floor based on the testimony that it is revenue neutral. You know, the funds that are addressed here do not affect the general fund at all. It's a separate UI account, and so I'm not sure if Mr. Jensen was going to flag this preliminary fiscal note as well, as he is diligent in doing his work. But that is my intent, Mr. Chair, is to offer a motion that would move this bill to the floor. So,
all right. Well, hang on, Senator Peterson. We still have, I think we have some testimony. Mr. Jensen, do you want to add some clarity to this on the fiscal note issue?
Mr. Chairman, members, this is a very small amount out of this fund. The fund expends $2.8 billion a year, so these estimates probably don't make any real difference to what's happening here. But this fund contributed to the general fund balance about $16 million from the special session. So we do look at all funds and see where the balances are. So, Mr. Chairman, I think going to the floor would be fine, but we would like to have the fiscal note completed when it gets to the floor.
Actually, I'd like to have it completed before it gets to this committee. But,
Mr. Chairman?
That's right. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, what does the 11:03 fiscal note say?
I haven't even opened it. I was enamored with the testimony we were taking today, Senator Tomasoni, so I didn't want to be rude in any more of a way than I usually am.
Well, you can go ahead and do it if you want.
let me ask while we think some more about the fiscal note issue. I have Mr. Hart, Rob Hart, to testify. Why don't you, either Mr. Nelson or Mr. Caligiuri can give up a chair for you, and we'll take your testimony, Mr. Hart, on Senate File 2224. Thank you for joining the committee this morning, and please give your full name and who you represent. Thanks for coming.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and ladies and gentlemen of the Senate Committee, for the opportunity to be here. My name is Rob Hart. You'll have to excuse the script, by the way. But I work for Employer Solutions Group, an Employer Solutions staffing group located here in Edina. And I serve as team lead over unemployment matters, along with my coworkers who are here, Andy Boisjolet and Lindsay Davies. We work with both permanent employers as well as staffing companies throughout Minnesota and as well as in 28 other states. So I speak as a representative, not just for our company alone, but for multiple employers. Certainly, the majority of the verbiage and the information that's being proposed by Senator Peterson, we have no issue with. Some of the verbiage that's being cleaned up certainly makes it a little bit simpler for our job and the day-to-day. However, there is one line item, speaking to the fiscal portion of this, that I would like to speak against, and that's line item 8.5 in Article 2, Section 4, Subdivision 5. Give a moment. This section speaks to the situation where an applicant earns less in wages than what they would receive in weekly unemployment benefits. Currently, 55% of those earnings are deducted from the weekly unemployment benefit amount, and then the balance is paid to the applicant and charged to the employer. The proposed change is to decrease the percentage to 50%, increasing how much the applicant receives and thereby increasing how much the employer is charged. The idea behind this change, along with the fiscal issues, appears to be to provide an incentive to applicants to stay in their current job or accept employment, even with reduced hours. And this is certainly a concept that we as employers and as a community would wish to encourage. Keep people working instead of sitting at home and just collecting a check. This concept seems to already be in play by the fact that it's at 55% and not directly being deducted from how much they would ordinarily receive. So there is already a fair portion that the employer is picking up. However, placing and continuing to place this extra burden on the employer, especially one employer that may have had to reduce the applicant's hours because the business is struggling, is, in our opinion, the wrong direction to go, because we, as well as our clients, not only pay the extra amount of benefits, but this amount of benefits paid also increases our tax rate. Instead, our stance is that we should not be charged for these extra benefits paid, nor should they be used in computing the future tax rates of a taxpaying base period employer, which is in reference to the Section 268.047 of the unemployment statutes, which allows for those sorts of instances. And especially in light of the increased tax burden that employers in Minnesota are already experiencing. The state of Minnesota already has one of the highest maximum experience ratings in the nation, which is especially punishing to our newer clients who are just getting started, and it continues to trend upward. As of 2012, we also now have the seventh highest taxable wage base in the nation. The highest is Washington State at $38,200. The lowest is Arizona and California at $7,000. We now come in at $28,000, an amount which continues to sneak upwards $1,000 almost every year. Some of the increases we've seen in recent years seem small in and of themselves, such as this change from 55% to 50% in line item 8.5. But taken together, it creates a discouraging picture for employers. These increases continue to punish and to place a heavier and heavier burden on companies trying to get started, trying to grow, in a lot of these instances, to recover, and ultimately provide more jobs for our community. Therefore, once again, we would request that this increase in benefits to the applicant not be charged against us as the employer. Thank you for your time. If there'd be any questions.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you know, this whole area of unemployment is very challenging. There's a number of features that I think folks would like to improve on as we move forward. My hope is to continue to be able to work on that. The contribution that employers make is directly related to how quickly this fund balance is paid back and brought back into the black, so to speak, and the rates that employers pay directly affect that. For example, an example I hear oftentimes is Wisconsin. But if I recall correctly, our fund balance right now is on track to be paid back by, I think it was 2014. Is that accurate? Okay. So our fund will be in the black in May of this year, for example. And Wisconsin, for example, I think owes the federal government still over $2 billion. $1.3 billion, and so it's a matter of the level of rates that we want to pay as employers compared to how quickly that unemployment fund can get paid back and brought into the black. And so I understand there's people on both sides of that issue, but the rates we pay that are in statute that click up when unemployment, with the more people you lay off, the higher rate's going to be. And as you move through that cycle and the less people you lay off, your rate's going to come back down. And that relates directly and the state's ability to pay back that fund. And so that's kind of the two sides of the argument and the balance that that you as legislators and myself need to try and address with those rates. So,
And Senator Peterson, has the UI Council grappled with some of these issues that Mr. Hart is raising? And I'll jump onto the back of that question too, Mr. Hart, and say, have you brought some of these concerns, which I think you've articulated well, to this council?
Well, in the day-to-day, I'm just taking care of the unemployment issues. Certainly we try to raise them as best we can.
Senator Peterson, has this been a topic of conversation at the UI Council?
Well, every item in this bill was discussed at the Unemployment Advisory Council through a process of a series of meetings. I do understand there's some disappointment in regards to our last meeting. I think you'll be hearing some testimony about what was canceled. I don't recall specifically of that. This particular issue was scheduled to be brought up. But others were, and others we'd hoped to talk about. But again, I would say it's safe to say the council had agreement on this issue. Again, it relates to the rates that you want businesses to pay will directly affect the state's ability to pay back the federal government at an interest rate of what that interest rate is. It's 2.9% that the employers in Minnesota have to pay the federal government for not having that fund. So in May, as you've heard, once that fund comes into the black, the employers in Minnesota start saving that interest rate immediately. So,
if I could ask Mr. Nelson or Mr. Caligiuri, you guys can flip a coin, but can you address some more of Mr. Hart's concerns as to how you guys have been wrestling with this? Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I could address a number of points that Mr. Hart made regarding unemployment insurance taxes. The average tax rate in Minnesota is actually just a shade above national average, but that's in tune with benefits, which are above national average. So that's a little bit of a misnomer when you try to point out only the maximum rates, because Minnesota's minimum rates are also well below national average. So you have to look at it from all points of view. Minnesota's much more experience rated than virtually any state in the nation. We charge those employers which have had layoffs. Employers who don't have any layoffs, on the other hand, pay very minimal unemployment insurance taxes. The purpose behind this particular section was discussed at length in our advisory council, which is also represented by the temporary staffing agency, is to incent applicants to take the part-time jobs. And so, the question really becomes, if more people leave unemployment to take, in fact, part-time jobs, there's less unemployment benefits actually paid out to the worker because they're having an offset.
So, you know, that's part of it. Part of the theory here is we want to incent people to take part-time and temporary jobs, who now will say, I don't want to take a part-time or a temporary job because it'll, you know, too much affect my unemployment benefits. This provides a little greater incentive for people to take those very jobs which Mr. Hart is offering. And that's part of the motivation behind this. So people will take jobs, those part-time jobs that our employers are saying we have available, that people will turn down because they'd rather collect benefits. We make a better incentive. Rather than providing a club over their head, we wanted to provide a little greater incentive and, you know, to get people. That's the theory behind this bill and that particular section of it. It will, in fact, benefit Mr. Hart. That's the purpose here, actually provide a benefit to him. More workers will, in fact, take those temporary and part-time jobs that are available out there. That's the purpose, and I think it will succeed. And that was the discussion, and that was the approval of the advisory council, which was made up of business groups. So that's the purpose.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I have a question along a different line. But I think Mr. Nelson might be the person to answer that. I was just wondering about the fact that the penalty payments would not be going to administration, but they would be going to the trust fund. And I was just curious. I was reading in on 5.33 that the administration account to be used to ensure integrity in the unemployment insurance program. So the penalties aren't going there anymore, and they're going to the trust fund. And I'm just curious, you know, if you can describe how that might affect administrations and the administration and its ability to ensure the integrity of the fund. I'm sure that was something the task force discussed, but I'd like to hear a little about that.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Nelson.
Senator Nelson. It will not impact UI administration at all. I don't know if I'm speaking untoward here from Mr. Calateri, my boss. UI is funded by a federal grant, UI administration, and currently we have sufficient funds to administer the UI program. That will not be an issue. While dedicated right to that purpose, if you want, we've never spent that money. In fact, I did make somewhat of an error to Senator Metzen. The legislature took that money for this biennium, and that's why this is effective July 1st of 13. It only affects the future. But the legislature, in fact, took all that money. So it isn't going to UI administration right now. It's going to the general fund. But this only applies to 2013 going forward.
Chair.
Senator Metz.
On that point, this fund collects the dislocated workers' money, too. Is that correct? And what happened there in the last session with that $25 million? Do you know, Mr.
Chairman, Senator Metzen, I don't believe it was 25. I believe it was 20 million. Was about 20 million was taken. The dislocated worker assessment is generally what it's called. Is collected along with the UI tax. The UI program collects it, and so employers generally just see it all as one, or believe it's all one. But it is in fact a separate tax, and that separate tax is what the legislature has taken about half of what's collected each year and put it in the general fund rather than use it for worker training is its
and
purpose.
Mr. Chairman, when the employers paid that in, they thought they were paying it in to augment or to pay for the dislocated workers program. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, that is what its purpose is.
We thought it was that purpose, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Mr. Jensen. On
Mr.
That.
Chairman, members, my understanding is that that $20 million or so is actually appropriations for training programs. We do not take $20 million out of the Workforce Development Fund. In a sense, it's taken, but it's direct appropriation for training programs. We've never, that I can recall, transferred $20 million just into the general fund to balance the general fund.
I don't. I, you're
Mr.
Chairman,
guy
over there, but I don't know.
Senator Metzen, I think the $25 million you're
I think it was $25 million that was transferred from something, and I guess I'm not.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the workers' compensation assigned risk plan.
Oh, okay.
And that's true. The Commerce Division took $25 million from that. And in this division, we took $13.7 million. And transferred it into the general fund to balance it. And it's based on earnings. Yes.
Thank you.
It's fun to watch Metzen and Jensen go at it.
He usually doesn't know what he's talking about.
Mr. Hart, is it on this point? Because I know I have someone else who wants to testify.
It is not. I just was going to make one concluding remark, and I can release my seat, as much fun as it is to sit up here. I certainly understand what Mr. Nelson is stating in terms of the incentive that's being offered and is actually already in place. I guess our stance was just that it doesn't seem necessary to continue to increase that that burden upon the employer. And we do agree with the idea of the incentive. It's just the increasing that burden onto the employer is.
Thank you.
There's a balance in there somewhere, and I guess that's something that the committee has to wrestle with. So thank you very much for the opportunity, though.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. Appreciate your points. Hang on, Mr. Jensen. I know I have one more person who wants to join the discussion, so please take a seat, and then I'll go to you after we hear another remark from Mr. Jensen. Mr. Jensen.
Mr. Chairman, members, from the unemployment insurance administrative account and contingent account. That's where the $16.3 million was transferred from. And this bill will change that, so all of that administrative and contingent fees and penalties will go back to the trust fund.
I think we have a difference of interpretation here, Mr. Jensen. I now have, that's a very negative shake of the head from Mr. Nelson. And so, Mr. Nelson, on Mr. Jensen's point, or against it, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, all deference to Mr. Jensen, who I've known for 20-some years, that's not exactly correct. It does not take all of the money from the contingent account, which in fact goes all to the general fund. It takes a very, very small portion, and that is required by the federal conformity law. It will take a very, very small portion of that amount. I can go through it with Mr. Jensen at another time and show him exactly in the statute where the contingent account still exists and all the money, almost about 95% of it, 90%, will go to the contingent account and then on to the general fund if the legislature so chooses to take it again.
All right, so we have a new face at the table. Sir, if you could just identify yourself for the record and your organization, and welcome to the discussion.
Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Craig Dexheimer, and I work for a professional staffing firm here in Minneapolis called Salo Oberon and Numberworks, where we have nearly 300 professional employees on our staff as W-2 employees who we offer a full suite of benefits, medical, dental, 401k, but they also look at their careers and in our industry as their profession. And I'm also on the legislative chair for our Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association here, and wanted to have this opportunity just to raise an issue that we feel could have been resolved in this advisory council bill. And during the 2010 legislative session, when the advisory council bill was going through the hearing process, language was added that we feel unfairly singled out our industry from a recruiting and staffing perspective. We have handed out the current suitable work statute, which you should have now, which contains what we feel is an objectionable provision. So you'll see in subdivision 23A, there's a definition for suitable employment. And then you'll see in 23G, when employment is not considered suitable. Subpart 4 is the provision that was added to the bill, and what the provision says is that employment with a staffing firm or staffing service is not considered suitable if less than 25% of the applicant's wage credits are from a job assignment with the client of a staffing service. In 23A, suitable employment means employment in the applicant's labor market area that is reasonable based upon the applicant's qualifications. The staffing industry serves numerous clients as well as many different labor markets. Suitability, we believe, should be based on the labor market area that is reasonably related to the applicant's qualifications, not on how the applicant obtained the actual position. This language was added to the Advisory Council bill without any discussion in the Advisory Council. In its original form in 2010, the 25% figure was actually 45%. The Staffing Association had actually asked for a repeal of the language last year, and the legislature changed the 45% to 25%. We feel strongly that lowering the percentage isn't really a solution. We respect the Advisory Council and the process where ideas are presented openly in a due process format and only added to the bill after consensus has been reached. It was our intent to bring this repeal in December to the Advisory Council process. However, the meeting in December was canceled when the draft bill was deemed to be finished. Mr. Nelson commented here this morning on the importance of helping incent our industry to help us provide jobs for people, to help remove them from unemployment and give those people opportunities. You know, we feel very strong that it should be important for you to know that we feel this provision is really unfair to staffing agencies because the employment that we are offering by our industry is deemed unsuitable not based on the similarity of the work being offered, but really because the work is coming from our industry. So one would believe that it is common for the applicants to switch industries, and that is why the suitable employment statute was written the way it was, requiring that an applicant's labor market area and qualifications be considered. So we just wanted to present this to you today to keep you in the loop and just to make sure that this stays front and center until we can get that law repealed. So thank you for your time.
I want to get this right. Dexmeyer?
Dexheimer.
Dexheimer.
Yes.
All right, I'm close. Mr. Dexheimer, do you... I'm not trying to start a fight here, but have you been... Do you feel like you have... your voice can be heard and that your industry can make its case at this council? And have you been able to do that? My sense is no, and that's why you're in front of the Jobs Committee now.
Yeah, we wanted to present the fact. Again, our goal was to go through the due process and go through the Advisory Council process and have this presented in December. And unfortunately, the intent was for us to present this to the council at that time, and that meeting was canceled.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I might point something out, we had three meetings prior to that. No time did they ever raise this up to say, well, we would like this put on the agenda. It was never raised as an agenda item until after, in fact, the meeting was canceled. If they'd have said prior to the meetings, we want this brought up, we would like to discuss it, it certainly would have been discussed. I might point out that this is not the only controversial particular provision in this statute which deals with temporary help agencies. Temporary help agencies have another particular provision of the statute which they advocate very strongly for, which are a number of interest groups who argue against. So there isn't just one particular provision which, you know, impacts this agency. I mean, this type of industry. There are other provisions which are, in fact, very favorable to them, which they would argue very strenuously to retain. And I think there's a balance here. It isn't just all one-sided. There's a multiple provisions here which are always kept in balance. And I think that has to be kept in mind. And the legislature discussed at length in conference committee this particular provision a number of years ago. And you know, it was adopted. And so I think there's a lot of discussion which surrounds the temporary help agencies, and it isn't something to just be dealt with because, you know, they have a little concern. They could have brought it up to the Advisory Council at any point in time for those three meetings, said, hey, we want it done some point prior to. So, I mean, that was available. So I just want to point that out. There was an availability for that discussion.
Mr. Dex?
Hi, Mark. Mr. Chair, I think a couple of points, you know, by all means, we do feel like we have made progress over the last several years from an industry standpoint, and there are things in the bill that we feel very positively about. I think one point to make is that last year, Senate file number 1229, we actually did introduce the bill to repeal the 45 to zero. So I think for Mr. Nelson to say that they were unaware that we had this, we've been working on this over the last year now. So from that standpoint, this is something that's been on the table. We've been bringing front and center to try to make sure that we are, again, our goal as an industry is how do we get people jobs and how do we give people that opportunity to get employed. And I think that is our number one focus. I know as Senator Peterson said this morning as well, from a job standpoint, that is our industry is focused on getting people back and working and fully employed. And I think the biggest point for us is just around, is it fair for us to be punished because we're providing them that employment opportunity? And it gets down to the suitability piece. And that's the piece that we want to just make sure that we can have this group consider and think about.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to necessarily rehash what did and didn't happen at that task force and what did or didn't happen at a December meeting, or that the fact that the legislature looked at this 8 years ago. I just not necessarily today. This probably isn't the time and place, but I do think it's important to note that this is a very different labor market than it was 8 years ago. And as a small business owner, I know that we're certainly looking at using a staffing agency because of the just because of the cost and the time that it is taking to do the HR functions in our business. And so at some point, I would hope there would be a discussion, and I don't know all the other provisions that you were referring to, Mr. Nelson, that apply to staffing agencies, but at some time, I think it's important for us to relook at this in light of today's labor market, and so I know it would take a more holistic view than we have today. But just to say that we discussed it 8 years ago, I don't think is sufficient for today.
Senator Peterson, further commentary, and then I'll ask if there's anyone else who'd like to testify on Senate File 2224.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members, to follow up on Senator Nelson's comments, my organization uses staffing agencies on a regular basis, and I find that the services they provide absolutely vital, and I would argue the services they provide are going to be a key component of this economic recovery. When you look at the large fixed expenses that businesses have specifically relating to workmen's compensation, for example, temporary staffing organizations allow employers to evaluate a worker, their ability to perform in difficult manufacturing jobs, for example, for a period of 90 or 20 days. Temporary staffing agencies are used as recruiting firms, in my view, to help service employers in this state and are certainly going to be critical to providing workers for this economic recovery that we're hopefully moving into the next several years. And I can assure you that this issue from our office in Senate District 15, the new Senate District 14, is not going to go away. We're going to continue to look at this issue and bring it up until we can come to an agreement. I do believe, I have shown that this is an issue that's important to try and address as we move forward. So.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. All right, members, so before we before we move this bill, if Mr. Nelson and Mr. Caligiuri, if you could come back to the table briefly, I'd like to get the department, the administration on record that regardless of some of the fiscal notes that we've seen on this, that you believe this has a zero fiscal impact. Mr. Caligiuri.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we believe that this bill is revenue neutral.
Mr. Nelson, you will affirm that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, had I seen this, I talked with the person yesterday at length who drafted this thing. I kept repeating to her, it is neutral. Here's why it's neutral. And I never saw what was actually put on paper. The first I saw it was when I walked into this committee. I would have had it corrected. I would have brought it up with Mr. Caligiuri when I talked with him over here. We were both astounded that it did not do what we had directed and explained to everybody
what it does. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Mr. Jensen, you believe this is this bill is revenue neutral?
Mr. Chairman, members, I just saw this as I came to the meeting today, so I do have some more questions, but I'd be willing to work with the department and get that straightened out before it gets to the floor.
Senator Peterson, so if there is a reason to pull this back off the floor, either to this committee or Senate Finance, I know you would commit to doing that, but assuming, or we're going to make that assumption here today, based on the testimony, that this can go to the floor. So Senator Peterson's motion is that Senate File 2224, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Senate floor. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Thank you, members. Thank you, Senator Peterson. Members, we do not have committee tomorrow because of the Senator Kubley services, but we do have a committee scheduled for Thursday afternoon. Kind of all the morning committee slots on Wednesday are going to go to Thursday at 4:30. Thank you, members. Committee's adjourned. Ready to go, Bill Bailey? All right. Another couple of downs.